notes in there.
Now, you know, certainly prefer that topic over a lot of others.
Could be better than a lot.
All right, we're just dealing with the presentation today. I think we'll go ahead and ramble in. You ready? Wonderful. Call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Let the record reflect that it is 10:20 a.m. on Tuesday, March 15th, 2022. I want to thank our House Record Secretary, Karen Polson-Edwards, and our LIO moderator, Talia Ames, for helping us with all the behind-the-scenes work here in our committee today. As we start, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please make sure your phones are on silent. Today we have Representative Tuck, Representative Rauscher, Representative Kaufman stepped out for just a moment, but I believe we'll be back here in a second, and myself, Chair Schragi. Today, the committee will hear a presentation from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory on House Bill 301, Renewable Portfolio Standard by the Governor. Is there anything to come from committee members before we get started here? And just a note, Representative Kaufman has joined us again in the room. Seeing nothing special to come before the committee, I'd like to welcome to our committee, Sherry Stout, with Arctic Strategic Program Manager, or the Arctic Strategic Program Manager and Senior Research Engineer at NREL's Cold Climate Housing Research Center, and Paul Denholm, Principal Energy Analyst and member of the Grid Systems Group in the Grid Planning and Analysis Center. We'll be taking questions throughout the presentation, so if you could please pause at the end of each slide, that would be much appreciated. Ms. Stout and Mr. Denholm, if you could please put yourselves on the record. And let me just note that Representative Fields has joined us at 10:22 a.m. If our presenters could please put themselves on the record and begin with their presentation. Thank you for being with us today. And Mr. Denholm, are you able to hear us here? You guys, are you ready to begin with your presentation?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Please put yourself on the record and begin. Thank you.
Okay, so do you have our slides up? We can't quite see the room from...
Yes, we do. And if you want to just maybe state what slide you would like us to be on as you proceed through, we'll make sure that we're staying synced up. And let me now note that Representative Klayman has joined us at 10:22 a.m.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you all for the opportunity to present today. My name is Sherry Stout. You'll also be hearing from my colleague Paul Denholm today regarding the Alaska House Energy Bill on the Renewable Portfolio Standards. And so I'm just going to give a brief overview of NREL and our goal of this particular project, and then Paul will do a deeper dive into the actual analysis. And so we'll be getting going here. If you want to move to slide two, it has the pictures on it. This is our core team. Just as by way of introduction, this is the core team that performed this analysis. We just want to make sure that you know you're being supported by a larger group of people than just what's on the phone today. On slide three, just for those who have not worked with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory before, NREL is one of 17 U.S. Department of Energy national laboratories. We are the only of the 17 that have a mission purely in energy efficiency and renewable energy, and that includes a lot of technologies I'll go through in a minute. Of note, we also have a campus in Fairbanks. Many of you might be aware of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, and that is a part of NREL. And so we have campuses here in Colorado where Paul and I are speaking from today, labs in Washington, D.C., and then obviously our lab in Fairbanks. So slide number four. Just really quickly, NREL at a glance, and who are we? So NREL is a National Renewable Energy Laboratory, has about 3,000 people working here, and you can see all of our research areas there, but specifically, as the name would imply, we work in renewable energy. And that includes, obviously, different renewable technologies, solar, wind, a variety of water technologies, geothermal energy, as well as sustainable transportation, looking at vehicle technologies, hydrogen, those types of technologies, energy efficiency. A lot of that work is actually out of Alaska. In our Fairbanks campus, when we work on a lot of buildings work, we work in advanced manufacturing for energy systems, and then energy systems integration. And so that's largely what we're going to focus on today is energy systems integration is how you take renewable energy systems and bring them into the U.S. electric grids. And so that means hybrid systems with a bunch of different technologies in them. It means ensuring energy resilience and security, but it also looks at things like economics, planning, policy, and just market maturity when it comes to renewable energy. So all of that fits under energy systems integration, which is what you're going to hear primarily about today. So slide five, just a little bit more background, and I know I'm running through these fairly quickly. We're happy to answer questions, but really just want to get this over to the analysis side of this. But a little bit of background on what we do and why we're doing this analysis of the RPS for the state of Alaska. We've done this for a long time. So we've worked in RPS design and development since well before 1999, when some of the first RPSs were written. We've also, this year is the 10-year anniversary of the Renewable Electricity Futures Study, which Paul actually participated in as well. And that study specifically looked at how do we get the entire U.S. grid to 80%. And so we've been looking at these issues and specifically this level of grid integration of renewable energy for at least 10 years. And we're working on a lot of projects you might have heard of, like LA 100 or Puerto Rico 100, specifically looking at, you know, how do we get communities all the way even to 100%. It's a very different ballgame than 80%, so we're not going to go into those very deeply. But this is something that our lab has done for a very long time. This is an area that we work in quite a bit. So it's a little bit of just history of who we are. But actually to get into the study and into the meat of today's testimony, if you want to move to slide six.
And Ms. Stout, if I might interrupt you for a moment, Representative Rauscher has a question. I'm not exactly sure which slide the question relates to, but I'm going to give the floor to him.
Thank you, Chair Shragi. To the chair, I was just wondering, you had mentioned that when you were in this previous slide, you said a lot of the amount of the research was not done in Alaska. So could you kind of say how much research has been done in Alaska? And also, how many years you've been working on research in Alaska, if there's any? Thank you.
Absolutely. So I refuse to go back through paper files. So I'm going to just say my knowledge stops at when a lot of our electronic records stop. But we have worked specifically in high penetration grid, mostly off the rail belt, as early as 1995, that we have in digital records. We've likely been working significantly longer than that, but those are the first digital records I have. And so going all the way back to that particular research project was in Wales, Alaska, which was a high penetration wind diesel hybrid microgrid. Those wind turbines are no longer in function for a variety of reasons, not having to do with the grid integration as much as the wind turbines themselves. But we've been working in Alaska since then, and specifically on high penetration grids. So we've worked around the state, really from Iqaluit all the way down to Metlakatla, all the way out to ADAC. So we really work around the state, largely in energy planning. A lot of the work that we do is off the rail belt. We do some on the rail belt, but we work in a lot of the microgrids. So things like energy resilience in the microgrids, cost reduction in the microgrid systems. Personally, I've worked in communities that their non-PCE cost of electricity has exceeded $1.50 a kilowatt hour. And so a lot of the work that we've done is really focusing on energy efficiency and renewable energy, tackling those cost issues. But if you have specific communities that you're interested in hearing about work, we can talk to specific communities. But as a broad stroke, we've worked in the state of Alaska for well over 20 years, and then I think you're also aware of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center based in Fairbanks. And before they became part of NREL, they've been working on energy efficiency issues in the state of Alaska since 1999. So a lot of history working in Alaska, really familiar with the Alaska markets. I've personally worked in Alaska for about 9 years, so not as much history as some of our other staff, but I've worked around the state. Does that fit your question?
Yeah, I really appreciate the answer. Thank you very much.
And Representative Hoffman has a question at this point.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Stout, just wondering, how is NREL funded? What's the funding sources for it?
That's a that's a really great question. As a Department of Energy laboratory, a lot of our funding, in fact, more than half of our funding, comes from the U.S. Department of Energy. And so some of that is through things like congressional earmarks. Some of that is through competitive funding within different offices of the Department of Energy. Obviously, it's a huge office. We don't do a lot of the funding out of, some of the more nuclear-focused aspects of the department just because we don't have a nuclear defense mission. So our work is primarily funded out of EERE, which is the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. But we also work with OE, which is the Office of Electricity, and OS, which is the Office of Science. In terms of Alaska, there's some smaller offices that serve Alaska, specifically the Arctic Energy Office and the Office of Indian Energy. We work with them as well on the DOE side. On the non-DOE side, a lot of our funding comes from DOD. So, for example, we work with several of your military bases in Alaska on primarily energy security and resilience in order to enable their missions to be resilient and secure, particularly just given the geopolitics of the day. We work with the Department of Interior on a variety of topics. So mostly U.S. federal agencies are where we get our funding, kind of a smattering of all of the smaller offices, USDA, Forest Service, a lot of those offices. Internationally, a lot of our work is funded through the State Department, USA. So most of our funding is federal. It's not exclusive to that. Some of our non-federal funding also comes from the private sector. We notably have very large partnerships with like ExxonMobil, with Shell. So it really just depends on which aspects of the research we're looking at funding. But it's not just federal funds.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Not seeing any other questions, please proceed, Ms. Stell. Thank you.
So if you wanted to go to slide number 6, I'm just going to give some high-level goals of the study before I pass this over to Paul, as he is the lead analyst on this. So the goal of this study was really just to provide insight into the basic techno-economic feasibility of an 80% RPS. And with that, we were identifying some of the likely elements of such a portfolio. Is there a need for new transmission or storage? What's the role of a diverse energy mix? Of note also, one of the things that was really important to us was making sure that we did give every utility a voice in this. So we worked with every utility. We worked with multiple renewable energy developers to walk through the data to get information. I also want to say that we could not have done this without the support of AEA, specifically providing a lot of data, as well as a lot of the installers and utilities themselves providing a lot of data. So this has definitely been a group effort. We did the analysis, but the data came from within the state of Alaska primarily, not exclusively. So I just want to just make sure that is on record, as this was a very collaborative process in doing this analysis. With that, unless there are questions on those specific goals, which will be, I think, a little more clear as Paul presents, I'd like to hand this over to my colleague, Paul Denholm, who will go through the details of the study.
And before you take over, Mr. Denholm, just let me really quickly note that at 10:33 a.m. we've been joined by Representative Zlokowski. Thank you. Please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the study. So as Sherry said, I'll be going over the actual analysis that we performed. And slide 7 gives you a brief overview, very high-level overview, of what is traditionally called the integrated resource planning process, which is what most utilities do to understand the potential opportunities to evolve the power system, what power types of power plants would be installed to achieve least cost, achieve reliability, and other aspects of long-term planning. Given the short time frame of this study, we weren't able to do all of these things, and we focused on particular aspects that looked at a few different scenarios and examined reliability. I know you may have questions about those, and happy to answer those, but I'll go into quite a bit of detail about the planning process, what we did, and particularly the focus on the reliability elements. And so the preceding slides do go into considerable detail about those elements, starting with slide 8, which provides an overview of the two main things we focused on here, which were understanding the potential reliability impacts of 80% renewable systems, essentially making sure that we could balance load in every hour of the year. And the other element is understanding some of the issues around avoiding fuel costs and, of course, confirming that we could achieve an 80% renewable portfolio standard. The next slide, slide 9, provides an overview of the 4 steps we performed in this analysis. And again, I'll go over these in detail. But the first was to design what we call an electrical model of the rail belt system, which is essentially how do we expect things like load growth, what are the anticipated transmission upgrades that will be performed regardless of the renewable portfolio standard. And then after developing the model, we developed 6 scenarios to look at 2040, a base case, which has no additional renewables, and then a range, in this case, 5 possible 80% renewable portfolio standard scenarios. And again, I will go in detail about each one of these scenarios and the basics of each. After the development of those scenarios, we did extensive modeling of those scenarios to test the system for reliable operation. And if we found issues, we modified those scenarios until we developed a portfolio that met the reliability standards we were enforcing. And finally, the 4th step was to confirm that an 80% RPS was achieved and evaluate those fuel savings. The next slide provides, next slide 10, provides an introduction to step 1, or the development of the system model. The system model consists of the rail belt utilities, the 5 utilities divided into 3 regions. When we talk about these zones, these are electrical zones. These are not political zones. These are basically essentially the service territories of these regions, and considering all the transmission and distribution infrastructure. The north part of the northern zone is the Golden Valley, GVA. Then we have the central zone, which consists of MEA, Chugach, and Seward. And then the southern zone, Homer. Each of these 3 regions was considered to be part of a single balancing area. And what that means is they can coordinate operations to maximize energy efficiency. But it's important to note that these regions can and, in fact, do operate independently. We tested the robustness of these zones to complete disconnections from each other to make sure that they can stay reliable if the transmission system goes down. I'll repeat that multiple times because that is such a critical element, and I'll show you a couple of different ways that we tested these systems against things like extended transmission failures or outages. These 3 zones are connected by 2 major transmission systems or transmission interties, the Alaska intertie, which you can see in the map, and the next slide actually shows that in a little bit more detail. And then the southern intertie, the Kenai intertie, connecting Homer to the central region.
And Mr. Denholm, if I might interrupt, Representative Rauscher has a question.
Thank you, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Denholm. I appreciate it. Through the chair, I was wondering, number 4, the bullet on the previous slide, number 4, you talked about your evaluation for fuel savings. And I was wondering, did you guys also evaluate for the capital costs to achieve those ratings?
No, we did not. We did not have sufficient time to evaluate the capital cost savings, so we'll have to discuss that in context. But the primary focus was to look at avoided fuels, and then at later time, someone can do a more comprehensive analysis to compare the avoided fuel savings with the potential increase in capital costs associated with these scenarios.
Follow up real quick.
Follow up.
I was just wondering, do you have any idea how much time that would take?
It depends on kind of how rigorous and robust you would want. I think we'd have to follow up and get back to you on additional details about how long that study would take.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. If you would, thank you.
And Representative Fields.
Through the chair, just to clarify the answer here, are you saying you did not quantify capital costs for generation or transmission?
That is correct.
Thanks.
Not seeing any other questions at this time, please do proceed.
Thank you. Slide 11 gives you a better indication of some of the 2040 base conditions that we evaluated. Essentially, what is the difference between now and 2040? A few things include an anticipated load growth based on AEA and other projections of about 12%. And this increases the peak demand of the system to about 820 megawatts. We did not evaluate any changes to load shape. And what that means is, in 2040, we would model the system as people using electricity the same way they do now. The biggest difference or problem with that would, of course, be things like adoption of electric vehicles. There was not time to evaluate those changes. Other changes that we made were upgrades to both the Alaska intertie, upgrade to 250 megawatts, upgrades to the Kenai intertie to 100 megawatts, and then upgrades to the Bradley Lake facility, including the Dixon Diversion, which adds additional stored energy at that facility. We also retired, due to age, about 427 megawatts of fossil plants, retired and then replaced with various amounts of new gas fire generation. So these are basically the power plants that are nearing their end of their lives already. Those will need to be retired between now and 2040, regardless of any policy or RPS. Those will need to be replaced. So we retired the old ones and we replaced them with brand new, more efficient units. You can also see here the distribution of the load among those regions. That's the same as it is today. Again, the load just grows. The next slide is to develop the 2040 scenarios. In the base case, we assumed no additional renewables are added to the system. And then we developed five renewable portfolio standard scenarios. Now, to be clear, these five scenarios are not intended to be the optimum scenario or even the most likely scenarios. What we really wanted to do here is explore a range of possible scenarios. Again, what if we tried to do this mostly with wind and solar? What if we tried to do this with mostly hydro? What if we deployed some of the technologies that have not been deployed extensively in Alaska yet? So we really wanted to kind of see which scenario is more difficult or easier, a bunch of those kind of technical issues. And then in the future, moving forward, it's possible to determine what might be the more optimum mix of resources. It's also important to note that the 80% renewable portfolio standard is not applying to individual utilities. So it's not like each individual utility has to meet 80%. It's the rail belt as a whole needs to achieve 80%. And that's a common feature to minimize costs. If there are regions that have better than average renewable resources, maybe they can get an 82% and another region can get a 78%. It's an 80% rail belt wide. And of course, there's no trading out of state. This is an Alaska, internal Alaska policy here. The eligible renewables include the list shown in the slide, primarily wind, solar, hydropower, and then again, a number of technologies that have not been deployed extensively in Alaska, including geothermal and tidal power. We also incorporated the ability to burn small amounts of wood in thermal power plants, but that's not a major resource. The next slide, slide 13, shows the kind of the base case, and it shows the existing mix, so that how Alaska got its electricity, or the rail belt got its electricity in 2020, and that growth out to 2040, and again, the no new renewables case. And essentially what you're talking about is expansion, continued use and expansion of the existing thermal fleet, primarily oil and gas-fired units. Again, we talked about how we retired some of the older units and replaced them with newer, more efficient units. And this is that base case with the no new renewables case. If we go to slide 14, we can then see the beginnings of the five scenarios. The first one being the case with the largest amount of hydro. In this case, we added new hydro power capacity based on the characteristics of Susitna-Utana. Now, this is not saying that this is the plant that has to be built. This is just characteristics of that. So this could be an alternative set of hydropower resources, but we characterized it around that plant. You can see that large kind of dark bluish purple color, I think, would be the contribution from that hydro plant, and with the remainder of the contribution being mostly wind. Scenario 3 on slide 15 shows the case with the most wind and solar contribution. Essentially, what we did is built out a case where we added quite a bit of wind and solar in such that about 60% of Alaska rail belt electricity is being derived from wind and solar in this case. Slide 16 shows a case where we added, again, technologies that have not been deployed significantly in the state of Alaska, replacing some of that wind and solar with things like tidal power and new geothermal. Finally, slide 17 shows that we added some in-between cases to kind of get a full range to understand, are there any kind of in-between cases worth evaluating. So this slide shows you the full contribution, the full mix of the different renewable resources we then tried out to see if they worked and what we'd have to do to make them work. Slide 18 starts step 3, which is testing the system for reliability. And this is the most important step and the primary objective in developing the system model, basically making sure that we can keep the lights on. We do not report on systems that don't meet reliability criteria. We basically follow standard practice that we need to keep the lights on, so there's not a whole lot of point in talking about systems that don't. So if we find systems that don't keep the lights on, we either drop them from our scenario analysis or more commonly what we do is we figure out what we need to do to fix them. That's the primary fun of being an electrical engineer, is figuring out the problems and solving them. So in this particular case, this is what we would call an iterative step, where we identify the problems and we fix them by either doing things like adding transmission upgrades, or for the most part in this system, by adding different mixes of capacity, adjusting the capacity mix, which is often associated with adding additional thermal capacity. So we perform three tests for reliability that are listed on slide 19. Basically, during every single hour of the year, the system must maintain sufficient generation resources to meet the demand for electricity. Again, we have to keep the lights on. We also have to maintain operating reserves. This means we have sufficient generation capacity, either online or that can respond quickly to rapid failure of the single largest element in the system. So if the Alaska intertie goes down, if a large hydro facility trips offline or a large thermal plant trips offline, we must be able to rapidly respond to that outage condition so that no one actually sees the lights go off. We quickly respond to that, restore capacity to make sure that we can keep the lights on. We also recognize the fact that power plants can fail rapidly, but they can also fail and be out for extended periods of time, not only because of unforeseen events like a transmission line going down due to weather, but also that things need to be repaired. There can be maintenance. We performed extended multi-month simulations to look at what would happen if you need to take the Alaska intertie down for a month or two or even more. Not only that, we make sure it's robust to the outage of these interconnections and the single largest generator in each region. And slide number 20 shows you this the location of these extended outage cases. These are the systems that we took out for multiple months at a time to make sure that the systems remain robust. So these are these disconnection scenarios that I talked about. So while these interties are great in terms of reducing the cost of electricity to ratepayers, we also recognize that they are vulnerable to outage like all transmission or, quite frankly, all elements of the power grid. No single element, or in this case, no two single large elements are allowed to cause the lights to go out. So this is an example of the things that we basically broke to test the system to work. And this is, quite frankly, a big part of my job is to break things. I break things and I see if the lights stay on. And this study was no different. We broke a lot of things to make sure that the system would remain reliable. Slide 21 provides a brief overview of how we keep the lights on. In an 80% renewable energy system, where we're depending a lot on wind and solar to provide energy. But what we're not doing is we're not relying on the wind and solar to provide large amounts of capacity. We recognize the fact that Alaska is a winter peaking system and is also often not very sunny on periods of peak demand. There are also periods where it's not very windy. And so what this slide shows you is where we're actually getting the power to meet the demand during periods where, quite frankly, it's not very windy or sunny. The left-hand bar chart, we identified an hour or two of the year where, quite frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of wind and solar. And we looked at what is actually serving load during those hours. And the answer is it's primarily the existing and new fossil generation resources that we maintain and enhance across all the scenarios, as well as the existing and new hydropower. Basically, the dark purple at the bottom, that's the contribution from those fossil resources during hours where the wind just isn't blowing very much. You can also see some contributions from energy storage in kind of the pink color. That's also making a notable contribution. And yes, there is some wind available during these periods, but it's not very much. You can see that in greater detail in the right-hand curve. We identified a period where both the load was relatively high and we had bad wind and solar conditions. You can see the little arrow pointing to an hour where we have what's called the maximum net load. The details of that aren't really important, but what you can see is there's no PV, there's no solar resource during that hour. There's also very little wind. So this is kind of your perfect storm, right? This is the time which, again, what do you do when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine? Here's the answer to that. You can see a few hours later, the wind picks up, and that's great. It helps reduce the output from those fossil plants. But during the hours where the wind is not blowing, the sun's not shining, we are relying on the existing and new fossil generators. We're also depending heavily, again, on the hydropower resources, not only because they can provide source of capacity, but the flexibility that those hydropower resources can provide, the ability to ramp up and down and respond to the variability of the wind and solar.
That's a question.
Representative Fields has a question.
Thanks to the chair. So my takeaway, Mr. Denholm, is yes, from a technological perspective, we could certainly reach 80%, recognizing that during the winter months and maybe other periods, you're basically using a very significant amount of, in Anchorage's case, natural gas. So what are the economics that you've seen on, say, we recently built a giant natural gas plant, very expensive, consumers are going to pay it off. What are the economics of, we're going to have that forever, basically maintain it, rebuild it because we need it in November, December, where we have almost zero PV generation, for example, and we have to account for the intermittency of wind. Have you ever seen a state that has had to have such a large reserve of gas to turn on, in our case, during winter months? And what are the economics of paying for that and adding that to all the renewable generation that we also have to build? Thank you.
Yeah, so that is a huge part of what I want to talk about. And so if you'll humor me for just a minute, if you'd allow me to get through the technical parts and just one more slide on that, and then we'll talk about avoided costs and the importance of understanding the avoided cost issues that you just raised. Is that okay?
Yep, that's great.
Great, thank you. Because again, one of the things that is important to point out is the variability that we are talking about here. And so this is the issue, is how do you know that you're actually getting to 80%? Because during any hour of the day, during any day of the year, you're getting a lot more than 80%, or in many cases, a lot less than 80%. You can see here the day-to-day contribution of renewables. So that's the blue squiggly line going up and down between 100%. There's a bunch of days in May where, you're spring runoff and it's really windy, and that's great. And you've got some days where the wind isn't and sun isn't providing very much energy. So this is the confirmation of the 80%. And then you can start to evaluate the fuel savings. Once you've kind of made sure that you've achieved 80%, look at the fuel savings, where that fuel savings is coming from. One other thing that's really important to note, of course, is the role of things like the upgraded Alaska Intertie. This kind of complicated graph is essentially showing you, this is slide 23 that we're on now. The previous slide was 22. That was the variability graph, and then this one is slide 23. So do we need to go back to 22 to talk about that one? Apologize for not advancing.
Do members have questions on slide 22, or would they like further expansion on this slide? Not. yes, Representative Rauscher, we can keep it on this slide for a second. In fact, Representative Kaufman has a question, so that will maybe give you the time to analyze this slide. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Happy to provide a spacer here. Through the chair, Mr. Denholm, just wondering, are you ever tasked to provide an analysis of the most cost-effective and reliable energy mix as opposed to a certain certain percentage of renewables? And just wondering, do we have a study like that for Alaska? Thank you.
We do not. We have not done a study of Alaska. We do that all the time. So we do a lot of studies where we figure out what is the cost optimal mix of resources, either under a renewable portfolio standard of a certain amount or elsewhere. So one example where we were given a specific constraint, of course, was the LA-100 study. I was the lead engineer on that study, where we were trying to determine what is the least cost mix of renewable resources to achieve 100%, again, under the reliability constraint. Under other cases, we're just simply trying to understand what happens if, under no policy constraints, what's the least cost of mix of resources. Again, that is primarily under the auspices of the Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Program. So oftentimes what we're trying to do is say, okay, what if solar gets 20% more cheaper? What would we expect to see the least cost mix of resources? How much more solar would we expect to see under those scenarios? But we absolutely do least cost mixes. We just haven't done one for Alaska.
Thank you.
All right. Please do proceed to slide 23 at this time.
Thank you. Okay, so slide 23 is emphasizing the role of the Alaska Intertie, giving you an example of how that resource could be used. And again, one of the things that's important to emphasize is I've almost never seen a study where transmission doesn't ultimately pay for itself, regardless of renewable energy. Look, I'm a transmission guy by background. I like transmission regardless. But one of the things that transmission helps to do in addition to just reducing overall costs and increasing reliability is increase the integration of renewable energy. So this is an example of flows on the Alaska Intertie over several days in January. Essentially what you're seeing here is in the orange line, you're seeing the supply of wind. So we built a bunch of simulated wind up around the Fairbanks area. And what you're seeing is the first couple of days, you've got wind that isn't that great. So what you're seeing is south to north flow. So the orange line is fairly low. And you have what we are representing here is negative flows, representing basically Fairbanks is importing energy from the south to make up for the lack of wind. Then all of a sudden you've got a fairly rapid increase in the supply of wind energy. In fact, Fairbanks now has more wind than it actually has electrical demand. So it's exporting, meaning a north to south flow into Anchorage and the surrounding areas, and they can back off on their thermal generators or their hydro generators and import that wind from the north. So this is just an example of how the Alaska Intertie would ultimately provide the opportunity to have more sharing of these resources and deployment of more renewable energy where it's cheaper, even if that region can't use all of that renewable energy locally. And if we want to get on and start talking about fuel savings, we can do that on the next slide, which is 24. So what does a renewable portfolio standard actually do in terms of fuel savings? So we've already talked about this a little bit. Essentially what you're doing is you're saving the cost of fuel and you're increasing the capital cost of the renewable energy. So what are some things that we can do to understand whether or not this makes economic sense? With the understanding that we don't have the full analysis for you, so this may be a little bit unsatisfactory, but we can at least get some of the pieces of the puzzle here by understanding the potential fuel savings and tease out maybe a little bit of insights into the capital cost. This chart is essentially showing an example of avoided cost calculation for the Aklutna power plant. Now, this is a fantastic power plant. I love this plant. It's super flexible. It's a really key source of reliable energy for the Alaska Rail Belt. It's relatively efficient. It does all kinds of great things for the kind of the Palmer area. It's about 170 megawatts. And based on its fuel reporting from MEA in 2020, it had a reported fuel cost of about $7.80 per million BTU. If we look at the actual fuel consumption rate, it used about 6 trillion BTUs of fuel in 2020. And if we kind of do the math on all that, we're looking at an avoided cost or variable fuel cost of about 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Okay, what does all that mean? It basically means that if you can sign a power purchase agreement at or below 7 cents per kilowatt hour, the avoided fuel cost alone will pay for those renewable energy investments. So it doesn't really matter the capital costs associated with the including the power plant. That was a good investment. The point is, if you can just avoid the variable cost at or below 7 cents per kilowatt hour, it's basically a no-brainer. Now, depending on what you believe will happen to fuel prices in the coming years, those avoided fuel costs potentially go up. So if you can't build a wind farm or a solar plant for 7 cents per kilowatt hour, what we call levelized cost of energy, or again, whatever the power purchase agreement, if you can't do that yet, maybe you can do it next year. You can see those lines increasing, and that's the case is essentially the break-even cost, that power purchase agreement. So if you don't think the price of fuel is going to go up very much, you've got a few years, maybe it's still 7 cents, maybe eventually it goes up to 8. Again, the key thing is here, any power purchase agreement from any renewable resource at or below this value will produce a net savings in costs. Again, regardless of the ongoing costs associated with maintaining this resource for reliability. And if we I'm assuming there might be questions on that. Otherwise, I can go to the next slide.
I thought Representative Rauscher had a question there, and it turns out he does. Representative Rauscher.
I get it about the fuel and the ratepayers and the fuel costs, but we also have capital costs and we also have maintenance costs that they're still paying too. And I'm just wondering, is it a total win or did it go up? The ratepayers, are they paying more because of it, because they're still paying the capital costs? Or what was the final outcome on all that right now as you look at the ratepayers paying today?
Yep. So the point is that this power plant is built, and so you're going to have to incur those ongoing capital costs and the fixed maintenance costs regardless of what you do with building renewables. Again, if you build renewables, it acts as a fuel saver. And so, again, as long as that cost is less than the variable cost, this is really just a savings, period. There are some bonus things that you do get from this. This particular plant had a capacity factor approaching 50% in 2020. It'll last for multiple decades, but if you can reduce the amount of energy it produces, you can actually increase its life. So that may not be a huge amount, but it is on the plus side of the balance sheet. So our primary benefit here is to avoid fuel costs, but you can also defer a lot of that maintenance or even defer investments in new resources by some potential years by running it less. And renewables will act to run it less, meaning, again, primarily avoiding fuel costs, but also potential opportunities to extend its life.
Any follow-up there, Representative Rauscher?
I'm not sure that did the ratepayers win or lose? I guess that was the end of the question.
Maybe Representative Fields' question will add to that. Representative Fields?
Thanks to the chair. Certainly no fault of NREL, but no one has asked y'all to do the sort of optimized cost analysis that Representative Kaufman asked about. My question was, how long does it take you to do that, and do you have the necessary information to conduct such an analysis for Alaska? Thank you.
We have most of the information we need. We're really good at this, but there are some things that we don't have that we would need that would be Alaska specific, but I would have to get back to you to figure out how long it would actually take. I wish I could give you a better answer, but I can't at this point.
Representative Field, any follow-up?
Well, I think we're only looking at like 25% of the picture, which is, yes, we can achieve it. I have no doubt. And frankly, I have no doubt we would save money with higher deployment of renewable, but I think we don't know what the right mix is, and we don't know how to get there until we see what the costs are. So I think we should see that. And it seems apparent to me, you know, the governor in introducing this bill wanted to put out a press release 80% without figuring out how much it would cost or at what pace we should do it or if 80% is even the right number. So without that analysis, to me, it makes very little sense to advance this when we don't even have most of the information we need.
Any response to that? Don't feel obligated to, but if you had comments you wanted to add, please do, Mr. Daniel.
I'll just have to keep going and
very good.
Go through this and, yeah.
Please do. Thank you.
Okay, so the next slide gets you an additional piece of that picture. So, you know, again, we can talk about avoided costs for individual plants, and we can also talk about kind of the cumulative avoided costs. Because, again, this is a cumulative effect. It takes a long time for these benefits to accrue because these are multi-decade investments. So slide 25 shows you the potential cumulative fuel savings along the path to 80% or again, whatever number you ultimately decide on. Essentially what happens is you start deploying renewable energy and you start saving fuel. And the first year you don't really save that much because you haven't deployed that much renewable energy. So you can see kind of where it's zero, you know, starting in 2023 basically. But eventually those lines start going up. So by 2040, the full implementation year, you're looking at somewhere in the order of, you know, $2+ billion. On the lower real escalation rate curve, and that increase, you know, those lines will diverge even greater. None of this, of course, captures the impact of volatility. So one of the things that's really important to talk about when we talk about avoided costs are you're locking in those savings. Every time you build a wind plant or a solar farm, you've basically just locked in the cost of electricity to the ratepayers for the next 20-plus years. they are no longer exposed to any price volatility whatsoever for the portion of their demand being served by wind and solar. You're always going to have some element of volatility from the remaining resources, but you've insulated yourself against price volatility over that time. Now, look, volatility goes in both ways. If you think the price of fossil fuels are going to decrease in the coming decades, then we'd have to look at the impact of kind of a negative price escalation rate. But if you want to insulate yourself against the possibility of short-term price shocks, renewables are one way to do that. That's just math, so I'm not trying to really sound like an advocate here. All I'm trying to say is that, you know, these are long-term firm contracts with a guaranteed price that, again, there's no escalation, there's no there can be escalation, but there's no volatility associated with those prices. So again, part of the thing that you guys want, which is that full price analysis, you would have to look at these cumulative fuel savings, compare them to the capital cost, and then kind of make the decisions in terms of not only the kind of the firm benefits associated with these avoided costs, but also any impacts and how you value avoided price volatility. So see if there's any questions on that.
Nope, no questions at this time. Please proceed.
So slide 26 is basically kind of summarizing the again, what we've already talked about, what happens with an RPS. You do have an increase in capital costs of the renewable infrastructure. You have a decrease in the capital costs of the fossil infrastructure. So again, you're going to build less fossil capacity, maybe not that much, but somewhat less. So that will tend to offset some of the costs, but clearly overall capital costs will increase. It's really a comparison between this net increase in capital costs and the decrease in the variable and fuel costs associated with that fossil infrastructure. So again, that is the real question here, and we can answer some of those questions, but we don't have the complete picture because we don't understand the total decrease in or total increase in capital costs. All we can do is look at the variable costs. And with that, slide 27 kind of summarizes what we've talked about here today in terms of there are multiple pathways that can achieve reliable electricity. It does result in substantial fuel costs, but we do need further analysis to determine that optimum portfolio, again, that minimizes overall costs while maintaining the high reliability standards that are critical to keeping the lights on. And with that, I can take any further questions.
Looking to the committee for questions on today's presentation.
I think thanks to the chair. In making that previous statement, I don't mean to denigrate at all the goal here. I think we should be aggressively deploying more renewables, but we just need to understand the best way to do that for Alaska. And my question, I think, specific to Alaska is we heard presentations previously on Hawaii and Colorado reaching some of these goals sooner. They're at a very different latitude, which I think has implications in terms of storage. So I think what I'd really like to see is it seems like in the rail belt, we're going to either need to maintain a lot more gas capacity for periods of low sun and low wind, and or a lot more storage. Maybe that's distributed hydro storage. I don't know if there's other cost-effective storage beyond the sort of very brief storage period of battery energy storage systems. And certainly we need those too. So what I would really like to understand is what is the optimum mix of either we're maintaining gas for those low sun and wind periods, or we're building a lot of sort of pumped hydro storage to account for those low sun and wind periods. So that's the analysis I would like to see. I did do the math. AEA has listed out capital projects, and their shovel-ready capital projects represent $7 billion in cost, which is $10,000 per person. Now, you know, I pay an average of well over $200 a month just for gas to heat my home. So the math might actually work out, but I'd just like to see the analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Dental. When in a prior presentation, we were seeing, you know, the lofty goals of, let's say, Hawaii, as mentioned by Representative Fields. And I was struck by how different they are than us. You know, that they have a different opportunity. Our opportunity, we have tremendous hydrocarbon reserves. And I think we just don't want to walk away from them too soon or at all, if that's really the best mix for us. I mean, we get dark and darn cold up here, and that's a just such a solid energy source that is available. The other nice thing is it produces jobs in Alaska. So if we buy, you know, windmills from Spain and solar cells from China, and maybe some battery storage using whatever from wherever we buy those battery storage systems, we're not doing much other than just importing equipment and setting it up. So I'm the other thing that I think would be great in the mix, if we could see can you factor in a prosperity factor in this of how jobs are created? If we're doing geothermal projects here, how we can somehow capture value in our state for jobs and our own state productivity. Thank you.
Yep. So this is Sherry Stout. I'm going to at least answer part of that, and Paul might jump back in as well. So a couple of things. One, from a perspective of where is the energy coming from, I think you're right. Alaska has some of the best hydrocarbon resources in the country, and exports most of that. I think where this adds a little bit of diversity to that mix is that refined product is primarily coming up from Washington versus being refined in the state. And so you're still reliant on a supply chain, even though it's sort of a different supply chain, exception obviously being the coal that is near Fairbanks. So, yeah, I think that's one thing to sort of consider within these supply chains is where are those weak points in the supply chain. But in terms of your jobs question, there's a different tool. We are nerds, and we're just going to embrace the nerd analysis that we do. We have a different tool called JEDI, which is Jobs and Economic Development Impact Index. And that specific tool can take any sort of renewable energy build-out that you do, and it looks at the jobs created at various stages. So first and foremost, it looks at the jobs created during construction. You're always going to have more construction jobs in a solar wind project, and you're going to have a maintenance because they don't take the same maintenance as a thermal plant's going to take. You're not changing oil. You're not changing gears for the most part. Wind turbines, there's some gears. And so you're looking at that construction phase first and foremost. And second, you're looking at the operation phase. And so what does it take to operate these systems? We also take that job economic development index and say, what are the ancillary jobs that are created around this? What are those secondary jobs? So not only are you going to have construction jobs, but then you're also going to have, and Alaska knows this probably better than most states, you also have to have all of those support networks. That's hotels, that's restaurants, that's gas stations, all of those things that are supporting the movement of the labor force into developing these. So the short answer is we don't know what those job impacts are going to be today because it's not an analysis that we've done. At the same time, if the state of Alaska starts pursuing more and more renewable development build-outs and is trying to make some decisions based on jobs, that's another way to optimize. So obviously, you know, you heard Paul talk a lot about optimizing around cost. Definitely can do that. We've also worked in places that optimize around job creation. Less so in the United States. That's more something we do internationally for places really looking to build job markets, is they optimize their energy mix to meet whatever policy goals they have around the most job creation. So those are different things you can optimize towards.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you. Just so you know, I like nerds, so I appreciate that. It's great to geek out on data and try and think of everything and bless those who do, because that's how we get to the best solutions. But I I'm looking at things that every location is endowed with a certain resource mix, and I just want to repeat again, I just hope that we do not ignore ours as we pursue a lofty goal that may fit better elsewhere or at a different point in time. I think, you know, the adoption curve can be the bleeding edge as opposed to the leading edge. If you deploy technology that may soon be displaced by something even better. So we just hate to think that we lock in on something that doesn't play out as the optimal solution over the long term, especially while we have such an endowment of resources here that we could develop if we were just to do so or to be allowed to do so by the feds. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. Representative Fields?
Thanks to the chair. Just a process question. What does it take for NREL to start doing that optimized cost analysis? Can the committee request that? Does it take the governor requesting that? Because I would sure like for you all to get started on that ASAP so it can inform decision making.
So I'm going to say, first and foremost, you know, when it comes to those funding streams that we actually talked about way back at the beginning of this, ultimately it takes funding. And so all of those funding streams are directly tied to certain outcomes and certain research projects and certain analyses. So first and foremost, quite frankly, just being nuts and bolts, just like a state government, it's going to take funding. And so in terms of getting started and our timing and staff, that is not such a concern. But these studies tend to be more expensive, because we are largely using, we have high performance computing, supercomputers, that we run a lot of this on. It also takes a lot of time. Paul is amazing. And reserving his time is something that we would definitely do for this type of task. So the short answer is it takes funding. The longer answer is it would also take some additional work, probably, with some of the entities that exist within the state of Alaska, such as the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. They have some of the cost information that would flow into this, continued work with the utilities and with AEA. So specifically, like, it's a data question of how long it takes to get data. But in terms of requesting it, we work with state governments. We work, you know, at any level. That could be the legislative bodies, that can be the governor's office, that can be the energy authority. So that part isn't such a challenge to us. But the first and foremost question would be, where is the funding coming from to do the analysis?
Additional questions from committee members? We still have just a little bit of time here. Not seeing any. I want to thank our presenters for being with us here today to walk us through this information. It's extremely helpful. Seeing no additional questions, our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 17th. The committee will take invited testimony from the Alaska Rail Belt Utilities. And with nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 11:16 a.m.